let us now see the list of injuries deemed to result in permanent or total disablement, where almost 100% of loss of earning capacity is to be given in case the employee loses both hands or amputation of higher sides, loss of a hand and a foot, in case there is a double amputation through leg or thigh or amputation through leg or through one side, or loss of another foot, in case there is a loss of sight to such an extent that to render the employee incapable of performing any work for which eyesight is essential, very severe facial disfigurement and absolute deafness. In that cases, 100% of loss of earning capacity is what is required. A list of injuries deemed to result in permanent partial disablement and amputation cases, upper limbs, either arm. So typically amputation through shoulder joint, in that case it's 90% loss, a percentage of loss of earning capacity. Amputation below shoulder with stump 80. Amputation from tip of acromion to less than below the tip of olecranon 70. Similarly, loss of hand or thumb and four fingers of one hand, in that case 60. Loss of thumb 30%. Loss of thumb and its metacarpal bone 40. In case of four fingers of one hand 50. Three fingers of one hand, it's again 30% of loss of earning capacity. Loss of two fingers 20, and loss of terminal phalanx of thumb without loss of bone is 10. In case of amputation cases of lower limbs, so suppose if there's amputation of feet resulting in end bearing stumps, 90% of loss of earning capacity. Again, amputation through both feet proximal to metapharyngeal joint, metatarsal pharyngeal joint, it's 80. Loss of all toes of both feet 40. Loss of all toes of both feet proximal to the interpharyngeal joint, it's 30. Loss of all toes of both feet distal to the proximal interpharyngeal joint 20. Amputation at hip 90. Amputation below hip with stump exceeding 12.70 centimeters in length, measured from tip to the greater trochanter, it's 80. And amputation below hip with a stump exceeding 12.70 centimeters in length, measured from tip of greater trochanter but not beyond middle thigh, it's 70. Amputation below middle thigh to 8.89 below knee, 60% of loss of earning capacity. Similarly below knee with stump exceeding 8.99 but not exceeding 12.70, 50%. Amputation below knee with stump exceeding 12.70, 50. Amputation of one foot resulting in end bearings, again 50. And loss of all toes of one foot through metatarsopharyngeal joint, it's 20. Similarly, other injuries, loss of one eye without complications, the other being normal, 40%. Loss of vision of one eye without complication or disfigurement of eyeball, the other being normal, it's 30. And a loss of partial vision of one eye, it's 10. In case of fingers of right or left hand, index fingers whole, 14% of loss of earning capacity, two phalanges 11, one phalange 9, amputation of tip without loss of bone 5. For middle finger, similarly whole 12, two phalanges 9, one phalange 7, and amputation of tip without loss of bone is 4. Ring finger, similarly whole 7, two phalange 6, 1, 5, and amputation of tip without loss of bone is 2. And toes of right or left great left foot great toes through metatarsophalangeal joint 14, and parts with some loss of bone is 3. Any other toe through metatarsophalangeal joint 3 and parts with some loss of bone is 1. Two toes of 1 foot excluding the greater toe through metatarsophalangeal joint 5 and parts with some loss of bone 2. Through metatarsophalangeal joint 6 and parts with some loss of bone 3. And four toes of 1 foot excluding the great toe, again through the joint it's 9 and with some loss of bone 3. Complete and permanent loss of the use of any limb referred to in this schedule shall be deemed to be equivalent to the loss of that limb. Let us now discuss the social security schemes. Again, very important, this enactment is a kind of social security legislation. It came into force in the year 1923 In the year 1948, the Employees State Insurance Act was introduced. The latter scheme rests on joint contribution by the workers, employers and the government. The two legislations, that is the Act of 1923 and the Act of 1948, together could be called Code of Social Security Benefits for the workers. Hospital industry is at present covered by the Workmen's Compensation Act 1923. We have already discussed this act. Now let's come to occupational diseases. Schedule number 3 of the Act gives the list of the occupational diseases. The schedule should be read and remembered along with the provisions of Section 3, Subsection 2, 2A, 3, 4 and 5. Employer not liable for compensation. Section 3 of the Act speaks of employer's liability for compensation with some exceptions enumerated therein. So let us see what are the exceptions. In respect of any injury which does not result in total or partial disablement of the workman for a period exceeding 3 days. In respect of injury not resulting in death or permanent total disablement caused by accident which is directly attributable to workmen under the influence of drinks, drugs, a willful disobedience of the workmen, the willful removal or disregard by the workmen of any safety guard or other device which he knew and which was provided to him but he has neglected the same. Industrial Dispute Act 1947. The objectives of this act were to prevent and settle industrial disputes, to secure and preserve amity and good relations, to promote good relations through an external machinery of conciliation, courts of inquiry, labor courts, industrial tribunals, national tribunals, to prevent illegal strikes and lockouts, to provide relief to workmen in matters of layoffs. So, you know, there was a time when there was an industrial era. At that time, this act was of great importance, even today. But there was a time a lot of industries were there, and strikes, illegal lockouts, all these things. So this act was enacted in 1947, and the main agenda or the main objective of this act was to prevent and settle all the industrial disputes and to prevent all illegal strikes. What does a strike mean? It means stop of work by a body of persons employed, or a refusal under a common understanding of any number of persons who are or have been so employed to continue to work or to accept employment. Strike can take place only when there is stop of work or refusal to work by the workmen acting in combination. A refusal to work under a common understanding of any number of persons to continue to work or to accept employment will amount to strike. Going on mass casual leave under a common understanding amounts to strike. So when we correlate it with hospitals, we see a lot of times, especially in government hospitals, sometimes doctors going on strike together. So going on mass casual leaves amounts to strike. If on the sudden death of a fellow worker, the workman acting in concert refused to resume work, it amounts to strike. For example, in the case of National Textile Workers Union versus Sri Meenakshi Mills in the year 1951, the striking workmen must be employed in an industry which has not been closed down. Even when workmen cease to work, the relationship of the employee and employer and the employee is deemed to be continued, albeit in a state of belligerent suspension. So what are the types of strike? Stay in, sit down, pen down, tool down strike. In all such cases, the workmen, after taking their seats, refuse to do work. Go slow. Go slow does not amount to strike, but it is a serious case of misconduct. Yes, employees are present, they are doing, but they are working absolutely slow. Sympathetic strike, hunger strike. We have seen a lot of this in recent time. Worked rule, since there is no cessation of work, it does not constitute a strike. Layoff means the failure, refusal or inability of an employer to give employment to workmen whose name is borne on the muster rolls of his industrial establishment, who has not been retrenched. The failure, refusal or inability to give employment may be due to shortage of coal, power or raw materials, the accumulation of stocks, the breakdown of machinery, and the natural calamity, or for any other connected reasons. I was just reading the other day in Japanese countries, you know, when workers go on strike, typically they don't stop the work, they don't slow down the work. It's just that they wear a band around their arm to show to the management that they are on strike. That's indeed a very innovative way of communicating the message. Essentials of layoff. There must be a failure or refusal or inability of the employer to continue employees in his employment. Yes, the employees laid off must be on the muster rolls of the establishment on the day of layoff. The failure, refusal or inability to give employment may be due to shortage of raw materials or accumulation of stocks or breakdown of machinery or natural calamities or some other reason. Lockout. So what is a lockout? The essentials of a lockout are as follows. There is a temporary closing down of the place of employment or suspension or withholding of the work by the employer. There is an element of demands which the place of employment is lockout or closed, and there is an intention to re-employ the workers if they accept the demand. So it is more of, you know, complete closing down of the place, or sometimes, you know, there is a kind of disagreement between the employers and the employees, and there is an intention to re-employ the workers if they accept the demands of the management. Prohibition of strikes and lockouts under section 22 and 23. Strike in a public utility service. No person employed in a public utility service shall go on strike in breach of the contract without giving notice of strike within 6 weeks before striking, within 14 days of giving such notice, before the expiry date of the strike specified in any such notice, and during the pendency of any conciliation proceedings before a conciliation officer, and 7 days after the conclusion of such proceedings. A strike notice is valid only for 6 weeks. I would say strikes should be actually avoided as far as possible, especially when it's related to a public utility service, as it causes a lot of disturbance, a lot of inconvenience to the public at large. Lockout in public utility service without giving to them notice of lockout within 6 weeks before locking out, within 14 days of giving such notice, before the expiry of the date of lockout specified in any such before as aforesaid, during the pendency of any conciliation proceedings before an officer, and 7 days after the conclusion of such proceedings. A lockout notice is valid only for 6 weeks. Illegal strikes and lockouts. Under section 24, a strike or a lockout shall be illegal if it is commenced or declared in contravention of section 22 to section 23, as we have just discussed, or it is continued in contravention of an order made under section 10 subsection 3 or section 10A. So there are penalties for illegal strikes and lockouts. Any workman who commences, continues, which is illegal, shall be punishable with imprisonment for a term which may extend to 1 month, or with a fine which may extend to rupees 50, or with both. So penalty for illegal lockout. Any employer who commences, continues, which is illegal, shall be punishable with imprisonment for a term which may extend up to 1 month, or a fine which may extend up to rupees 1000, or with both. Penalty for instigation, which is illegal, shall be punishable with imprisonment for a term which may extend to 6 months, or with a fine which may be up to rupees 1000, or both. Penalty for giving financial aid for illegal strikes and lockouts shall be punishable with an imprisonment for a term which may extend up to 6 months, or with a fine which can be up to rupees 1000, or both. Retrenchment, it means to end, conclude or cease. It however does not include voluntary retirement of workmen, retirement of the workmen on reaching the age of superannuation, termination of the services of the workmen as a result of the non-renewal of the contract of employment, and termination of the services of workmen on the grounds of continued ill health. Thus, the definition contemplated following requirements for retrenchment. There should be the termination of service of the workmen. The termination should be by the employer. It should not be the result of punishment inflicted by way of disciplinary action. This is very important. And the definition excluded termination of service on the specified grounds or instances mentioned in it. Now, there is a procedure for settling of industrial dispute. So this act provides an elaborate and effective machinery for bringing about industrial peace. The various authorities in this are the Works Committee, Section 3, the Conciliation Officers, Section 4, Board of Conciliation, Section 5, Courts of Inquiry, Section 6, Labour Courts, Section 7, Industrial Tribunals, Section 7A, National Tribunals, Section 7B. So what are the powers and duties of the Works Committee? It shall be the duty of the Works Committee first to promote measures for securing and preserving amity and good relations between the employees and the workmen. Very, very important. Comment upon matters of their common interest or concern and endeavor to compose any material difference of opinion in respect of such matters. This is very important. Wide ranging as welfare of workers, supervision of recreational facilities and creche, hospitals, training, wages, hours of work, bonus, gratuity, holidays, with pay and working conditions, including discipline, promotions and transfer. So, you know, all these things have to be taken care of so as to maintain a healthy working atmosphere for the employees, and this becomes the duty of the committee. Conciliation officers duties: in case of disputes, the officer may hold a conciliation proceeding. It is the duty of the officer to investigate the dispute and all the matters affecting the merits and the rights of settlements thereof. They have certain powers, and they may, for the purpose of inquiry into any existing or apprehended industrial dispute, after giving reasonable notice, enter the premises occupied by the establishment to which the dispute relates. A conciliation officer may call for and inspect any document which he has ground for conceding to be relevant to that industrial dispute or to be necessary for the purpose of verifying the implementation of any award or carrying out any duty imposed on him under the Act. So he has the power in relation to that particular dispute. If he wishes to inspect any particular documents or a part of the premises, he can do that. So the Board of Conciliation, they have certain duties, and it is their duty to bring about a settlement to the dispute, also to send a report and the memorandum of settlement to the appropriate government, to send a full report to the appropriate government settling for the steps taken by the board in case no settlement is arrived at. The board shall submit its report within 2 months of the date on which the dispute was referred to, or within such shorter period as may be fixed by the appropriate government. Now, the board also has certain powers. The member of the board may, after giving reasonable notice, enter the premises occupied by the establishment to which this dispute relates. A board shall have the powers as vested in civil court, namely examining any person, compelling the production of documents and the material objects, issuing summons for the examination of witnesses. Courts of inquiries, duties are: the court shall inquire into the matters referred to it and submitted reports within a period of 6 months. A court has to abide by the principle of fair play and justice. This is again very important. Court has to abide by the principle of fair play. It should not work in partiality. Powers: a member of the court has the power to enter into the premises and the same powers as vested in the civil court. Most important, labor courts. Section 7, the appropriate government may constitute one or more labor courts for adjudication of industrial dispute relating to any matters specified in the second schedule. The presiding officer of a labor court must be a judge of the High Court, district judge for a period not less than 3 years, held any judicial offices in India for not less than 7 years, and less has been the presiding officer of a labor court for not less than 5 years. Now, what are the duties? The duty is to adjudicate upon industrial dispute relating to matters specified in the second schedule, to give award within the period specified in the order. This is very important. Within the specified period, you know, whatever the judgment is to be done. Powers: a member of the court has the power to enter the premises, and it has the same powers as vested in a civil court. Where an industrial dispute has been referred to a labor court, the appropriate government may, by order, prohibit the continuance of any strike or lockout in connection with such dispute which may in existence on the date of reference. Let us now discuss industrial tribunals under Section 7A. The duties of the industrial tribunal is to adjudicate upon the industrial disputes relating to the matters specified in the second schedule or the third schedule and to give an award within the period specified in the order. They have certain powers. A member of the court has the power to enter into the premises and the same powers as vested in the civil court. Powers to appoint assessors to advise in the proceedings and powers to award cost. National tribunal's duty is when an industrial dispute has been referred to a national tribunal for adjudication, which shall hold its proceeding expeditiously. The award shall be in writing and shall be signed by the presiding officer of the national tribunal. Similarly, powers of the court are to enter into the premises, and it has the same powers as vested in the civil court. Power to appoint assessors to advise it in the proceedings, and power to award cost. Award and settlement. Person on whom settlements and awards are binding. A settlement arrived at by arrangement between the employer and the workmen is binding on parties to the agreement. An arbitration award is binding on the parties to the agreement. A settlement is arrived at in the course of the conciliation proceedings and shall be binding on the parties to the dispute. Very important act again, a Trade Union Act of 1926. It's the law relating to the registration of trade unions. The act came into force on 1st June 1927. The object of this act is to regulate the conditions governing the registration of trade unions, obligations imposed upon the registered trade unions, and the rights, liabilities of the registered trade unions. Why? Basically, we know a lot of trade unions had come up, so in order to regularize so that things go in a proper way, this act was a very helpful act. So what's a trade union? Regulating the relations between workmen and employers, between workmen and workmen, and between employers and employers. It includes any federation of two or more trade unions. So registered trade unions under the act, it essentially means a trade union which is registered under the act. What is a trade dispute? It means any dispute between employers and workmen, between workmen and workmen, or between employees and employers, which is connected with the employment or non-employment, or the terms of employment, or the conditions of labor of any person. And workmen means all persons employed in trade or industry, whether or not in the employment of the employer with whom the trade dispute arises. So this is very important again. A workman basically means all persons which are employed in the trade or industry, whether or not they are in the employment of the employer with whom the trade dispute arises. Registration of trade unions. What is the mode of registration? Any 7 or more members of a trade union may apply for registration by subscribing their names to the rules of the trade union. Application of registration of a trade union shall be made to the registrar along with a fee as prescribed under regulation, ₹5 at present. A statement of the following particulars: the names, addresses and occupation of the members who are making this application, the names of the trade union and the addresses of its head office, and the title, names, age, address and the occupation of the trade union. Where a trade union has been in existence for more than 1 year before the making of an application for its registration in Form A, a general statement of all its assets and liabilities prescribed in the prescribed form also has to be delivered to the registrar together with the application. So this is the procedure for application. Rules of trade union under section 6. A trade union is entitled to registration only if its executive is considered in accordance with the provisions of the act, namely the name of the trade union, the whole of its objects, the whole of the purposes for which the general funds of the trade union shall be applicable under section 15. Maintenance of the list of members of the trade union and adequate facilities for the inspection thereof by the office bearers and the members of the trade union. The admission of ordinary members who shall be persons actually engaged or employed in an industry which the trade union is connected to, and also the admission of the number of honorary or temporary office bearers to form the executive of trade union. The payment of subscription by the members of the trade union which shall be prescribed by the act. Also, the conditions under which the member shall be entitled to benefit assured by the rules and conditions under which fines may be imposed on its members. The manner in which the rules shall be amended, varied, or rescinded. The manner in which the members of the executive or other and other office bearers of the trade union shall be appointed and removed. The safe custody of the funds, this is very important, of the trade union, and the annual audit, this has to happen, of the accounts thereof. The manner in which the trade union may be dissolved. So, most important is the funds which the trade union collects has to be proper, it has to be in safe custody, they have to be subjected to proper audits, and how the trade union may be dissolved in case things are not working out fine. Rights and privilege of trade union, body corporate, section 13. Every registered trade union is a corporate body by the name under which it is registered and has perpetual succession and a common seal with the power to acquire and hold both movable as well as immovable property and to contract and buy and can by the said name sue and also be sued. Separate fund for political purposes under section 16. A registered trade union may constitute a separate fund from contribution separately levied for or made to that fund from which payments may be made for the promotion of the civic and political interest of its members. So we have seen this, so many of such cases, you know, where a lot of these trade unions have political interest. So a separate fund is to be maintained for that. Funds of a registered trade union, the Act provides for two types of funds, that is the general funds and funds for political purpose. General funds, the payment of salaries, allowances and expenses of the office bearers of the trade union, the payment of expenses for the administration of the trade union, including audit of the accounts of general funds of the trade union, the expenses in prosecution or defense of any of the legal proceedings to which the trade union or any member is a or any member thereof is a party undertaken. Also, the conduct of trade disputes on behalf of the trade union or any members thereof. The compensation of members for loss arising out of trade disputes. This is again important. So, members, in case of trade disputes, members have to be compensated in case of any losses arising. Allowance to members or their dependents on accounts of death, old age, sickness, accidents, unemployments, or any such matters. The issue of or the undertaking of liability under policies of assurance on the lives of the members or under policies insuring members against sickness, accidents or unemployment. Also, the provision of educational, social or religious benefits for members, including the payment of expenses for funeral or religious ceremonies for deceased members or for the dependents of members. Also, the upkeep of periodicals published mainly for the purpose of discussing questions affecting the employees or workmen as such. Political funds of registered trade union. Under section 16, the payment of any expenses incurred either directly or indirectly by a candidate as a prospective candidate for election as a member of any legislative body constituted under the constitution or for any local authority. The holding of any meetings or the distribution of any literature or documents is support of any such candidate or prospective candidate. The maintenance of any person who is a member of the legislative body constituted under the constitution or for any local authority, and the holding of political meetings of any kind or the distribution of political literature or political documents of any kinds. Thank you.